using fiction to examine social power and privilege.
One of the things that I seem drawn to over and over again is simply this notion of the exploration of power. How power is wielded, who uses it against whom. This is a theme that you will see in almost all of my work. And what interests me as a writer is to examine these larger questions of power in a small, domestic, family setting.
That's Thriti Umrugar. She comes back to Writer's Voice to talk about her new novel, Everybody's Son. It's about the adoption of a poor black child by a powerful rich white family. Then we talk with climate journalist Marion Lavelle about Trump's Paris pullout and the Exxon shareholder revolt. Then we celebrate World Ocean Week with Carl Safina. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and at writersvoice.net. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon. Novelist Thriti Umrugar has made the theme of the use and misuse of social power and privilege a frequent theme in her novels. An India-born American writer, Umrugar has usually examined this theme through the lens of her native land or the lives of immigrants from it to America. But in her new novel released this week, Thriti Umrugar explores issues of race, class, privilege, and power in a wholly American setting. Everybody's Son is about two families, one black, one white, and the uncomfortable moral questions that arise when white privilege and wealth are used both for good and bad. Thriti Umrugar is the critically acclaimed author of 9 novels, including The Weight of Heaven, The World We Found, and The Story Hour. She's been a guest on Writer's Voice talking about those novels, and we're very happy to have her back on the show talking about her latest, Everybody's Son. Well, Thriti Umrugar, welcome back to Writer's Voice.
Thank you so very much for having me again.
Now, this book, Everybody's Son, is really the first novel of yours that does not at all feature somebody who is from India or from South Asia, either in this country or abroad. It's the story of a biracial boy who is adopted by a wealthy white family after his mother, who's a crack addict, is held captive in a crack house and is unable to return home to him. Tell us a little bit more about the broad outlines of the story.
Yeah, so basically I wrote this book as a exploration of, you know, what risks and what rules would somebody be willing to break in order to rebuild his or her family. And in this case, this question is posed to one of the two protagonists. You know, his name is David Coleman, and he is wealthy, influential. When we first meet him, he's a judge. Later on, he becomes governor of his state. And he is introduced, he and his wife, after the loss of their son, decide to adopt this young 9-year-old black boy. They initially get him, you know, they are foster parents to him. And he quickly realizes how much potential this boy has and convinces himself that he can do better for this boy, Anton, than his own biological mother can. And so uses his sort of power and influence to pull a few strings that makes it possible for him and his wife to adopt the boy. And then the rest of the novel is sort of about the consequences of this one action that is, you know, it's not terribly honorable. He basically, you know, takes this boy from his rightful mom and the impact of this decision on all their lives.
And on the surface, I'm sure many readers may think to themselves, and And I did myself, that, well, he's in a better place. He's given more privileges he would not have had if he'd stayed with his mom, although she's not an unsympathetic person, just as David Coleman is neither. You know, he's not unsympathetic, but you can condemn him from some of the things that he does. So I wonder if you could address this very knotty question and how you approached it, both when you started writing and as you went through the book, the idea that, you know, he was saved from a worse fate and what that means.
Yeah, so one of the things that was really, really important to me in this novel was that I did not want to indulge in, you know, the simplistic tropes of, you know, a wicked white racist versus an innocent black woman, because David Coleman is certainly not that. And neither is the mother, for that matter. You know, they are, I wanted them to be living, breathing, flesh and blood characters as realistic as possible. And we know this from all of our lives that, you know, people are not one or the other. I mean, most of us are some combination of good and bad. And we all make mistakes. We perhaps all even sin on occasion. But most of the time, you know, we do it with the best of intentions, perhaps. And it was important for me that this novel have that kind of nuance to it. In a sense, the novel also examines the limits of liberal piety. It was important to me to not make David Coleman some kind of a caricature. It was very important for me to really make him this person who is struggling. You know, he's struggling with his own unresolved grief of having lost his much-loved biological son. And then when fate sort of brings Anton to him, it's virtually impossible for him to give that up. And the way he convinces himself that all the actions that he takes to make this possible, he doesn't say to himself, you know, this is my need that I'm trying to fill, but he makes it about, I can provide a future for Anton that his mother can not even imagine, right? And that's how he does it.
And this isn't the first time that a theme like this has arisen in your novels. In The Weight of Heaven, there's a man who loses his 7-year-old son, and then he transfers his feelings onto the son of his housekeeper. So with The Weight of Heaven, again, an issue of the clash of privileges, you know, with the ties of families. So why is this theme something that you seem to be working over in your fiction?
Yeah, you know, it's a very interesting question. And frankly, I don't know if I have a good answer for it. I'll tell you a little bit about sort of the genesis of Everybody's Son. You know, the novel came to me in its entirety in a span of about 15 seconds. I mean, and this was the first time that I've had something like this happen, where I knew the names of the characters in that span of 15 seconds. I knew the entire story. I knew who these people were, what they were going to do, why they were going to do it, all of that. So it was more of an instinctive choice than anything else. And, you know, I find it slightly humorous, understandable, but humorous when people talk about how this is the first novel that doesn't have any Indian characters, nor is it set in India. I mean, that is absolutely correct. But the flip side of that is the issues that I deal with in this novel, you know, in one way or the other, these are issues that I've dealt with, as you just indicated, in all of my books. So while the names of the characters and the setting and the plot line might differ, one of the things that I seem drawn to over and over again is simply this notion of the exploration of power, you know, how power is wielded, who uses it against whom. This is a theme that you will see in almost all of my work. And what interests me as a writer is to examine these larger questions of power in a small domestic family setting, you know, because that's where I think, frankly, for most of us, most of our life is lived, you know. So I'm not necessarily looking at power at the macro level, you know, in the halls of power in Washington, D.C. I'm interested in knowing how all of this trickles down, all of societal beliefs, all of our cultural values trickle down to the family level. And that is why you're seeing this parallel, perhaps, between The Weight of Heaven and this new book.
And if you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Hriti Unregar about her latest novel, Everybody's Son. And this really comes to the fore also in a figure that is not so much actively present in the book, but is present as a force in the book, and that's Juanita, that is Anton's mother, where, I mean, to use that overused term, maybe intersectionality, I mean, she is the victim of power in many ways, both by gender and by race.
Yes, very much so. And yet, I'm hoping, without giving too much away, I'm hoping that one of the refreshing things about this book is, you know, the fact that I've created a character who, by every sort of yardstick and demographic measure, ought to be a victim. And she isn't, for one simple reason, and that's because she chooses not to see herself as a victim. And because of that, she makes decisions and choices that sort of liberate her from victimhood. You know, that was really important to me also, just as it was important to not make David Coleman a stereotypical, you know, powerful white man who uses his power to, in some ways, do harm, you know, also to do good. I wanted that complication in his mirror image, if you will, which was Juanita.
And yet there is a lie at the center of what he does, and that has a pernicious effect over time on his son.
Yeah, very much so, very much so. And one of the other things, I mean, almost as an aside, is that David seems blissfully unaware of the complications that arise, you know, in any kind of transracial adoptions, and you know, the kind of divisions that normally, or the kind of complications that normally exist, are really amplified in his case just because he comes from such privilege and some wealth, and he basically has taken this boy, plucked him out of a housing project, and installed him as a kind of princeling in this all-white, very affluent community. And he doesn't seem to gesture toward what this would mean for this boy. He basically raises him the same way that he had raised his white son, with no recognition of what this entails. And I think as a consequence of that, as you alluded to, the fact that this has fairly disastrous impact on Anton in terms of his identity. I mean, he is a young boy who grows up lost, and frankly, in some ways, despite all his success, his work success, really is somebody who doesn't know who he is. And part of the book is his journey toward some measure of self-recognition, self-acceptance.
Yeah, and he, you know, this is kind of expressed in two relationships that he has. One that he has in college with a very militant young black woman that doesn't last. And then later on, his relationship with a white woman who is, you know, totally part of the program, I guess, that his father has laid out for him, and yet a sympathetic person as well. I wonder if you could talk about those two relationships that he has.
Yeah, I mean, I think as you mentioned, the relationships come at different junctures in his life. I mean, you know, he's still very young. He's an undergrad when he meets Corrine, the militant black woman. She's a huge influence on his life. She is actually the first black person that he is drawn to and becomes very close to, apart from his mom, who he hasn't seen in, you know, over a decade. And Corrine is a very no-nonsense person, and she seems to relish the prospect of, how shall I say this, you know, sort of popping his balloons. You know, every time Anton feels a little self-important or even self-righteous, she is there to sort of pop that balloon for him. But she is a good guide and a good teacher. And one can argue that perhaps at the very end, well, two things. I mean, one is that he is intimidated by her and basically realizes that his life is going to be challenging if he ends up with her long term, because she is somebody who will challenge his beliefs, make him think for himself, make him question things all the time. And Anton, at that point in his life, is a little intellectually lazy, maybe, or certainly emotionally lazy. He doesn't want to do the hard work that it would take to be happy with Corrine. But Corrine herself is young. You know, she is only 20, 21 years old herself. So some of her self-righteousness and militancy is also a little bit of posturing, you know. And at some point, Anton sort of has a glimpse of that. And that turns him away from her also. The other woman in his life, Catherine, who he meets much later in life as an adult, is very much her own person. But she is not an antagonistic presence in his life the way Corrine occasionally is or often is. She is, you know, she is white herself, and she does not recognize that Anton needs to grapple with some of the issues of identity, and certainly doesn't push him. And so they have a much more affable and comfortable relationship than he ever does with Corrine. I hope that's a good enough summary.
Oh, that is. That is. And if you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Hriti Unregar about her latest novel, Everybody's Son. Now, issues of identity, I mean, these are things that are, of course, come up quite a bit in your books. You were born in India. You came here when you were 21 years old to the United States.
Right.
And yet this is a book about, you know, an African-American boy who's also biracial, who lives, you know, his father was also white and privileged, although he's really not a presence in Anton's life at all. And then his adoptive father, of course, as we've spoken. I wonder if you had to wrestle with any questions of cultural appropriation and turning your, you know, in turning your pen to this very different community and these issues of identity.
Yes and no. I mean, on one hand, I have certainly written about characters who come from different countries or different racial backgrounds than I do. You mentioned The Weight of Heaven, you know. As you might recall, The Weight of Heaven is a story of a young white American couple who find themselves living in India. It's been very interesting to me that nobody asked me this question when I wrote The Weight of Heaven, you know, even though I was most certainly writing about a culture that was different than mine. My most recent book, called The Story Hour, is told from two alternating perspectives. One is that of a recent Indian immigrant to the United States, but the other major character is Maggie, an African-American therapist. The questions of cultural appropriation came up a little bit with The Story Hour, but certainly not as much as they have and will with this book. You know, I was not trying to be deliberately provocative or to make some literary or political point with this book. I wrote this book because I believed in my story, and I thought that perhaps it could contribute something useful to this endless age-old debate about race and racial relations in this country. You know, critics can call me an Indian American writer. I don't see myself that way. I see myself as a writer who has no interest in telling the same story over and over again. I want to stretch and grow and widen my horizons with each book that I write, you know? And you have to understand that my entire adult life has been spent living in the United States. And I am an intensely political person, you know? I was a journalist for many, many years. I certainly wrote about race relations and transnational adoptions and you name it, the debates and topics that had very little to do with my own life. So, and I teach African American literature, you know, so I have a background in that. So the gap between who I am in my skin and this book is really not as far-fetched as it might seem to somebody from the outside. And I do, as a matter of principle, I do believe that writers should always reserve the right to write about whatever the heck they wish to, whatever subject matter they wish to tackle, as long as it's done with integrity and honesty and a desire to, you know, to not inflame or hurt or provoke in a negative way, but to simply, you know, do what any good novel does, which is build communication and build empathy and build understanding.
Well, you just said you wrote this to, I don't remember the exact words you used, but to further deepen an understanding of race. And I wanted to ask you, boy, we live in such a time, you know, that is not post-racial by any means, that has been where the racist tropes have been revived, have been intensified. I wouldn't say revived, actually, they were always there, but certainly intensified with the latest election. Could you say more about what you would like to do through your work in deepening this understanding of race and where you see that we are right now?
Yeah, it's a great question. I mean, the last part is the easiest to answer, which is we are in a terrible place. And I am one of those old-fashioned writers, perhaps, who really does believe in the power of literature. And I think one of the things that literature does that very few other vehicles in our society do is literature can build empathy. You know, this is the reason why I was drawn to books as a young child in India. It helped me live in somebody else's skin for a few hours. And that ability that literature confers upon us, you know, the ability to pop out of our own skin and occupy somebody else's skin, I think is just crucial. So I also think that the choice that I made to not make, you know, David Coleman is not a Southern governor from a red state, you know. He lives in a very liberal, unnamed state out east. He is part of, quote-unquote, the East Coast liberal elite. And yet, when it comes to sort of getting for himself what his own heart desires, which is having Anton be his son, having Anton in his life, he does not hesitate to use his power and influence. I feel like by making that choice, by not making him a racist caricature, I hope that I'm saying something subtle and yet complicated about white privilege and about race. But at the very end of the day, if you're asking me what I hope the takeaway from this book is, I want this book to be judged by the same criteria that I want all my novels to be judged by, which is, you know, is the storyline credible? You know, are the characters memorable? does this novel produce empathy in the reader? Does it help us understand a different person or a different way of life or a different culture a little better? Those are the things that I'm trying to do with this book.
And finally, even beyond the differences, beyond the empathy for those who we see as other, beyond the discussion of race, there is the theme of forgiveness. I wonder if you could talk to that.
Yeah. Empathy and forgiveness to me go hand in hand. And you're right in that I spend a lot of my time talking about what literature does in terms of producing empathy. But it is impossible, I think, to forgive another human being without first at least having some notion of why they acted the way they do. And in terms of this novel, just to bring it home back to that, again, I don't want to give too much of the story line away, but clearly Anton gets to a point where his world basically comes crashing down, and he, as an adult now, has choices to make, as an adult who finally finds that healthy distance between his very powerful father and himself. He has to figure out whether being a person who can understand, being an adult man who can understand why his father has acted the way he has, and whether he is capable of forgiveness, will also feed into his own identity. It will also help define the man that he will become in the future, right? So in this novel, the notion of forgiveness, the notion of healing, the notion of tying up loose ends and sort of embracing all of life in all its complexity, in all its weirdness, you know, in all of its harshness, and then moving forward, not because of that, but despite all that, despite all the betrayals that Anton has suffered, it's a very, very hard-earned forgiveness that in turn will contribute to the man that he will become.
Well, it was a terrific read. The book is, the novel is Everybody's Son, and thank you so much, Thridi Omregar, for talking with us about it.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Thridi Omregar is the author of 9 novels, including The Weight of Heaven, The World We Found, and The Story Hour. Go to writersvoice.net to find links to our interviews with Omregar about those novels. Her latest, Everybody's Son, was released June 6 from HarperCollins. Next up, we talk with climate journalist Marion Lavelle about 2 big climate stories, Trump's Paris pullout and the Exxon shareholders' revolt. Stay tuned.
How high is the water, Mama? She said it's
4 feet. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. 2 major climate stories broke the news on May 31st. The first was that Donald Trump was likely to pull out of the Paris Climate Accord. And on June 1st, he did. The second story was in the opposite direction. Exxon shareholders voted overwhelmingly to force the company to disclose the impact of climate change and climate policy on its bottom line. I called up veteran climate reporter Marion Lavelle to talk about these 2 developments. I started out by asking her if she'd expected, as I did, that Trump would go ahead with his promise to pull out of the Paris Agreement.
As you said, it's not a surprise because on the campaign trail, he said that he wanted to cancel the climate agreement. And of course, he famously tweeted that he felt climate change was a hoax invented by the Chinese to harm U.S. manufacturing. He was very heavily lobbied by many people within and outside the administration to keep with the Paris Climate Agreement, just even from a self-interested standpoint, that the U.S. would have more say, more leverage from staying within that agreement with 195 other countries. And yet, from the reports, it sounds like he is not going to take that advice and is going to go with his first impulse, which was to leave the pact altogether.
So, and tell us what some of the pressures that were brought to bear on him. I mean, it is interesting that Rex Tillerson, the current Secretary of State and ex-CEO of Exxon, wanted him to stay. So who wanted him to leave?
The folks who inside the administration who seemed to be leading the charge to leave Paris were the Environmental Protection Agency Administrator Scott Pruitt, and also the White House counsel. Now, Scott Pruitt is very closely allied with some of the companies in the fossil fuel industry that are they have a very strong opinion on climate change. They do not see themselves operating in a way to really recognize that climate change is an actual issue. The interesting thing about Exxon is that for some time it has admitted that climate change is a real issue. They haven't done much to address it, but they admit that this is a reality. It seems that in the Trump administration, the folks who believe it is not a reality are holding sway at this point.
So tell us, what would this do if Trump does pull the U.S. out of the Paris Climate Accord? What would this do to the implementation of the agreement itself worldwide?
Right. And you hear almost from every country, at the very beginning of this year, China said, absolutely, we are in the Paris Climate Agreement. We are going to keep in there and take leadership on this. The countries have been very firm about that this agreement is going to go on. But it greatly weakens the agreement as a practical matter when the country that is the second largest emitter of carbon emissions is not making any commitment at all to reduce those emissions and reduce production and use of fossil fuel. It weakens the effect of the Paris Agreement, and it gives others an excuse to flee the agreement as well.
There have been some who say that the process of decarbonization has already started. It's inevitable that we will get there one way or another. Is the issue one of running out of time before we can protect the climate from reaching catastrophic stage?
Absolutely. It's about running out of time when you consider that we really have been hearing warnings publicly about this since the late 1980s. By some measures, we have only 5 years left to use up our carbon budget. Some say that it's a little bit longer than that, but really that is the problem. Now, under President Obama, we did reduce our greenhouse gases. We even got a third of the way to our commitment under the Paris Agreement. The problem was we needed more regulation. We needed greater ambition. We needed someone to follow the Obama administration to take us even further on renewable energy, further on cutting emissions from all different segments of the economy. And right now we're in a stage that really is at a critical time on climate change where we're going to be standing in place and we're not going to be reducing our emissions. Probably they're not going to increase very rapidly, but they should be going down, and they should be going down deeply at this stage of the game.
Now, some people have said that the emphasis, the leadership in terms of the U.S. leadership, is going to now turn to the states. Can the states come in and fill the gap that is being created on the federal level to rein in our greenhouse gas emissions?
Well, I think some of them are trying and some are going to try. California has been a leader on this for years. The problem is you will still have states, you will have Wyoming and Kentucky still producing coal. You won't have everybody working together to really address this as a team working together, because we have to do more than reduce our use of coal. We have to replace it with renewable energy. That we have to do it in a way that brings jobs to those people who will be losing their jobs as the economy transitions. If you did this as an integrated economic policy, study after study has shown that you will do far less damage to your economy than you will just pretending that climate change is not an issue that you're going to have to deal with eventually.
So that will be the economic impact on the U.S., you say, is going to be negative. What about on our credibility as a nation?
The fact that if we leave a pact that nearly every other country in the world has joined, like this international agreement, like the Paris Agreement. I think only Nicaragua and Syria are the countries that will be joining outside of this agreement. It has got to affect our relationships with other countries on a whole variety of things. There are some analysts who predict that this will have trade consequences for us. If we aren't regulating fossil fuel emissions, isn't that an unfair trade advantage? Some countries may argue that. They'll try to challenge us on that in the venues that look at international trade disputes. And absolutely, it has big implications for us internationally. And I think that that's why you saw Secretary of State Rex Tillerson on the side of, in his words, we should keep a seat at the table. Many people quibble that under his leadership, Exxon didn't do enough. I think that that's certainly a fair argument can be made, but he, at least in the administration, was on the side of acknowledging that climate change was happening, and he was arguing for maintaining our role in this agreement that we really helped to shape.
And we're talking with Marion Lavelle. She reports for the Pulitzer Prize-winning news site Inside Climate News. So now this leads us to the second big news. Rex Tillerson was the CEO of ExxonMobil before he stepped down to take the position of Secretary of State. And today there was a rebellion at the 2017 Exxon shareholders meeting. Tell us what happened.
Yes, it really is a stunning development, especially if you've watched this over literally 28 years. It became kind of this annual ritual that there would be a shareholders resolution or more than one resolution on climate change. And when those resolutions first were brought up around 1990, it was the first one, they would get about 6% of the vote. And it was kind of like that for years. Well, today, the shareholders voted that they wanted Exxon to begin reporting annually on the impacts of climate change as a business issue. Integrate it into your financial reports, do an analysis on what impact is it going to have on the company. If countries all over the world are making efforts to reduce their greenhouse gas emissions by using less fossil fuel, what is that going to mean to Exxon as a business matter? And the folks who really led this were the institutional investors. They have responsibility for the investments of retirees in the New York Public Employees Retirement Fund and the pension fund there, the Church of England's endowment. Also, many public employees' pension funds, but also some of the biggest institutional investors in the world, BlackRock, State Street, Aviva, they all have been signaling that they want more transparency on the actual financial risk that climate change poses. And it seems that in a very deliberate and organized way, they voted against management on this issue because Exxon had argued, as they have argued for years, that they are making sufficient disclosures on this. If the countries are enacting climate change policy, well, we'll mention that in our annual report. Well, what the shareholders are asking for is something much more detailed. They want a real scenarios analysis. What does Exxon look like in a world where nations are really cutting their fossil fuel use to prevent worldwide temperatures from rising more than 2 degrees Celsius? So this was indeed a big rebellion, and it really, it's a milestone. What happens now, it depends on how Exxon really responds to this, but it is a big moment for shareholders and shareholder activists.
So explain to those of our listeners who, you know, may not understand the connection between reporting and real-world results. So explain what kind of impact this could actually have on the world's efforts to fight climate change. That's number one. And maybe along with that, explain what the whole concept of stranded assets is.
Okay. There actually is a lot to unpack here. One thing that we should say outright is that some climate advocacy groups argue that this reporting actually just isn't enough at this stage, that we're really beyond the point where more disclosure is what's needed. They say, we don't need Exxon to study how climate change is going to impact its profits. We just need them to stop producing fossil fuels. And they argue that institutional investors should just be divesting, just getting rid of their investments in these fossil fuel companies as quickly as possible. Then you have the shareholder activists on the other side of this argument say that, well, if we want to get a company like Exxon to change its ways, to invest in renewable energy, to really become an energy company instead of a fossil fuel company, we need to engage with them. We need to, again, to use Rex Tillerson's phrase, we need to keep a seat at the table. And they see this as a first step. The transparency is a first step to Exxon really having to reshape the way it does business. And again, it remains to be seen whether that reporting is really a first step. In the past, Exxon has made reports, and certainly not with the financial detail that was asked for in the past. But the way that they have analyzed this is they say, well, we believe that oil is going to be the world's primary fuel decades into the future. They don't see renewable energy reaching any more than 4% of world energy demand by 2040. And most scientists say that would be a catastrophe if we have that low uptake in renewable energy. Furthermore, they say that renewables have reached a point where they can be competitive with fossil fuels, certainly on electricity, and perhaps with the electric car, with oil transportation. So, and that gets us to the issue of stranded assets. If we're all driving electric cars in the future, And Exxon is sitting on its assets. What it really owns is all of this oil. The company talked about 1.5 billion barrels of oil off of the coast of Guyana and some of its offshore assets. Well, those assets, what good are they? What money is Exxon going to make selling those assets if everybody's driving electric cars? So those barrels, billions of barrels, would be stranded assets. And you can see why that is an important issue to institutional investors. I guess the question is, will they be stranded assets or not? Exxon has been arguing that it doesn't see that happening.
But isn't the issue also the issue of cost of extraction? I mean, I have seen estimations that we have reached or are close to reaching not peak oil so much, although we may very well have reached that, but more peak price of oil, because as the rest of the world does transition more to renewable energy, the price of oil is just likely to go down. You need to have at least, I mean, above, I think, $50 or $60 per barrel in order to produce these assets, these offshore oil, fossil fuels. So has this horse already left the stable?
Right. And you have to wonder, and some of the activists who were working on this project on pushing for greater disclosure at Exxon have argued that we are already seeing the impact of the world turning away from fossil fuels. We are already seeing that in the price. Last year, the price of oil was lower than it was in decades. Now, that is because there has been this shale fracking boom in the United States, but it also is happening at the same time that demand growth for oil is flat and young people aren't driving cars the way young people used to drive cars. And there is change going on in demand that I think that the oil industry absolutely realizes is happening. So that is one of the things that the shareholders are arguing. But I think that it has to be said that once again, we are running out of time. And even though you see some of these companies, they're walking away from the very expensive oil development in the oil sands in Canada, for instance. But there still are companies that are saying, hey, we'll buy those assets and we think we can make money on them for a few more years. Well, we don't really have a whole lot more years to go. According to the science, we need to really work on deep decarbonization of the economy now.
Marion Lavelle. She reports for the Pulitzer Prize-winning news site, Inside Climate News. Find links to her articles for that site, including her post about the Exxon shareholder vote, at writersvoice.net. And it is World Ocean Week. We were reminded of this in a Facebook post by our friend and former guest, ocean defender, scientist, and author Carl Safina. So we looked into our archives and found a clip from the 2011 interview he gave us about his award-winning book, A View from Lazy Point, A Natural Year in an Unnatural World. Safina has a summer home on Lazy Point, a, quote, flat peninsula of scrubby pines, as he calls it, in Amagansett, New York. In his book, it becomes Safina's vantage point on the world's oceans, oceans that are in deep trouble from multiple assaults, including overfishing and global warming. Lazy Point came very much to mind this past week. A low-lying area, it was flooded by Hurricane Sandy. You have a wonderful quote by E.B. White starting the book. I arise in the morning torn between a desire to save the world and a desire to savor the world. And that seems very much to inform the way you've written the book. You alternate between writing about the grave dangers, the threats that face our world, as well as celebrating the beauty that still remains.
Yes, I've known about that quote for a long time, and I was a little reluctant to actually use it because it sums up my life a little too closely. But it's true, and it's one of the main motivations I had for writing the book, is that if you are in the environmental world, as I am, it seems like all you ever get is a lot of gloom and doom and a lot of terrible news. But if you're a naturalist and you look around and you just think about trends, you realize that, first of all, the world is still absolutely a beautiful place. And secondly, there are really dangerous trends, but there's a lot to inform us about other dangerous trends that we have lived through. Times have been very bad before. The future is not really knowable. And so I really reject the idea of just throwing up our hands and say the world is over, because we really don't know. But I do think that the trends now are very dangerous. There is a lot at stake, and I think everybody really should not hide from that either.
You say that, you know, it's possible to see the whole world in the view from Lazy Point. What are some of the changes that you've seen there that kind of bring this home to you?
Well, I think if you have your eyes open, you can see the whole world from anywhere. But what I've seen out at Lazy Point and in my life around Long Island, because to the extent that I have grown up, I grew up around Long Island and, I have some perspective. You know, it's just as far as nature itself, there's less of it. Some of the bird populations are down a lot. Many of the fish populations are down a lot. If you also look, you see some fish populations are up because of things that people have done. Some birds are back, especially the ones that were the most vulnerable, like ospreys and peregrine falcons that were just about wiped off the face of the earth by DDT and the other hard pesticides. Those returned after those pesticides were banned. So there's a tremendous resilience that you can see at work as well. And that is a tremendous reservoir of hope, because if we recognize what we're doing and back off or do the right things or change our course, then I think that we can recover a lot of these things that we are losing.
One place where there's both good and bad news is with corals. We could lose 50% of coral reefs this century, yet there's also reason to hope.
There are probably no places that are not in some peril, but there are success stories around in various ways. In the case of the coral reefs that I visited in Palau in Micronesia, the success there is that they had the wisdom, also partly because their population was low enough, they were able to do this, but they had the wisdom to prevent the export of fish from their reefs. And most people think that reef fish rely on coral reefs for their living, which is true. But another part that is also true is that the reefs rely on the fish themselves to stay alive, that the fish are constantly grazing the algae that's always trying to overgrow all the coral. And if you fish the fish down too low, the algae gets out of control. Once that happens, the coral dies and cannot reestablish itself, and it just goes from a coral reef to a rubble field full of seaweed, a very, very different thing that is a lot less productive as well.
Carl Safina tells a powerful story in The View from Lazy Point about the day he and his partner went looking for horseshoe crabs. Those ancient creatures used to be a common sight on the beaches of Long Island's East End, but they've been over-harvested, and they're now rare.
I was taking a walk in the moonlight along the shore, and I just happened to, it was a full moon. That's one of the reasons that I was out walking. And I just happened onto the spawning of the horseshoe crabs. I was new to the place, so I didn't realize that they spawned along that shore. And what they do in May and June in the full moons, they come up and lay their eggs at the highest reach of the highest tides. And then the next full moon stimulates the eggs to hatch, and the little tiny hatchlings go into the water. So I was enchanted by the scene of all these horseshoe crabs coming up and mating and digging nests and laying eggs in the moonlight. And I called my partner, Patricia, she came out, and we were delighting in the whole scene. And then a pair of headlights came bouncing up the beach, and it was a pickup truck with a fisherman, and we could suddenly hear the thudding of many horseshoe crabs going into the truck. It's the ones with the eggs that are the best bait. So he was trying to take every female who was there to lay eggs and throw them in the truck. Now, I don't have as much of an appetite for direct confrontation, but Pat simply decided that if he was going to take the horseshoe crabs off the beach, she was going to take the horseshoe crabs off the beach too, but throw them into deep water where he couldn't reach them. And when he realized that she was doing that directly to oppose what his plans were, he and I had a confrontation. She stayed in the water throwing horseshoe crabs into deep water at as fast and furious a pace as she could, because she was really wound into quite an anger about the whole thing. And he was making his case to me that it was all legal. And I said, yes, I know it's legal. And he said, and we have a limit, 500 a night. And I looked, I said, 500 a night? There's not 500 crabs here on the whole beach right now. You just can't do that with a hope of continuing to do it. He said, well, my grandfather used to do it. Well, your grandfather used to take a few for bait. He wasn't shipping them out of state for a dollar a piece like you can do now, because the whole market has changed and the demand has so thoroughly changed. So, you know, we didn't come to blows or anything like that. He was upset. I was upset. She was upset. Then another truck came by, and I thought, well, this really changes the balance of the whole conversation. But they conferred, and they decided to simply leave. And we left, of course, after a while. We came back in the morning. There were lots of trucks, tracks all over the beach. They obviously had come back. And when I went back the next month, instead of finding hundreds, I found six.
Horseshoe crabs.
Six horseshoe crabs, yeah.
Carl Safina is a MacArthur Fellow, an adjunct professor at Stony Brook University, and president of the Blue Ocean Institute. Find a link to our whole interview with him about the view from Lazy Point at writersvoice.net. You'll also find links to the interviews he's given us about his other books, including his latest, Beyond Words, What Animals Think and Feel. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight to your inbox or subscribe to the podcast and the newsletter. And follow us on Twitter at Writer's Voice, all one word. The Writer's Voice webmaster is Bill Way. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.